And so your mother was good about sharing.
Yeah,
she had with other people.
Very good about sharing with other people. I've never known her yet to get a request from a neighbor for some potatoes or whatever it was, or some vegetable out of their garden, or some meal or something. I've never known mother yet to turn down a request from a neighbor for, you know, she just didn't do that.
Did she have chickens too?
Oh yes, we grew chicken, poultry, so we had eggs. All of that's farm produce, yeah.
Sounds like you had a very healthy, wholesome environment.
Good. Yeah, well, it was good. And with the family values that my dad insisted upon, there was no basic friction between us children as growing up. We loved and respected each other. Now, it doesn't mean that one brother or one sister wouldn't get angry sometime once in a while, but it was nothing major. Nothing major.
Did your mother also have certain herbs that she could share with neighbors, or did the neighbors share them?
Yes.
Themselves?
Yeah. Now, she grew herbs in the garden, and the herb that was used most often for all ales, you had a plant in the garden called rue. I guess it's spelled R-H-U-E. And rue tea for any kind of fevers or headaches. There's another herb called tansy, which was good for headaches, and catnip. And then we had rabbit tobacco, which we called it grew out in the straw field, the ground that had been farmed over, that had been lying fallow for a year. Grew up a lot of rabbit tobacco, and you gather that about this time after the frost would hit it. And it was very good to make tea for colds, chest congestion. It worked. It really worked. And there was a whole galaxy of herbs which we use. Sassafras. Now the sassafras, the roots from sassafras where you use to make tea, we would use that just like people drink iced tea or whatnot. It wasn't, say, exactly used only as a medicine. It was used as a condiment also. Just like we like coffee, you make coffee to drink, or sassafras tea to drink. Epsom salt was another good one if child seemed to be a little constipated or whatnot, you'd give them a dose of Epsom salts. And don't let me forget castor oil. You ever hear of castor oil?
I've heard of it.
Yeah. Castor oil was one of the, well, quinine and castor oil were two of the staples. If you came in with a headache, you got some castor oil. If you came in with a stomach ache, you got some castor oil and quinine. And many a day can I remember when Dad would just want you to cast oil, you want to kind of halfway resist, he'd hold your nostrils and put the spoon of castor oil in your mouth, and you had to swallow it to try to get your breath.
He had his ways.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
Taking care of your kids.
Taking care of the kids.
Yes.
That's quinine and castor oil.
What about tallow and molasses?
The tallow, you know, tallow is beef fat. Get it from, and mixed it, tallow and molasses. That's another a syrup. Well, maybe spike it with a little bit of vinegar. That's very, very good for congestion. I can swear by that because I've used it. Yes, indeed. Tallow and molasses syrup. And a lot of times, at the chest, we take some of the tallow and put it on a cloth, like a flannel cloth, and hold it close to the fire, to the heater, get it nice and warm, put some tallow on there, and put that to the chest, and just put on your sweatshirt and leave it there overnight, and next day you just coughing all that stuff up.
Loosen up the phlegm,
that's true.
You mentioned a physician named Joseph Harrison.
Dr. Joseph P. Harrison was my old family doctor, and he was a very kind gentleman, my role model, a man whom I'm sure is responsible for many of my philosophical stances of medicine. He never said no to anybody and was always willing to give service. And he made many, many house calls, and one of his pet statements when he treat a person leaves, said, "Well, if anything goes wrong, call up." And he was very instrumental. In fact, his oldest daughter was a high school classmate of mine. She was a very, very smart girl, very smart girl. She finished at the salutatorian of our class. And Dr. Harrison would always come out to see about his daughter, and for many of us other country boys and girls, at that time, a dime would buy you a can of pork and beans and one of those loaves of bread. Small, we called it a 5-cent loaf, and then it would get later on, it went up to 6 cents, a 6-cent loaf of bread. And we kids would very often see it unsliced, where you take the large knife and that one loaf of bread, you cut it in half, and open your can of pork and beans, you mash down the salt part in the bread and make a little hole in there, and pour half of the pork and beans in one half and half in the other, and you get a meal for two kids, you know. That's 11 cents. Well, Dr. Harrison, when he would come by and stop by to bring his daughter Madeline some money, he would usually see, my family were all, we were all his patients. There were some other families too, but he usually leave 5 cents or a dollar to be spread around among us country kids, and he was always an inspiration, always an inspiration. And it far after appreciating what his work, I know that that's what got me interested in the medical profession, was seeing Dr. Harrison work and seeing his attitude toward life and living and people.
Did he help people in your family with difficult illnesses?
So did he what now?
Did he help your family with any prolonged illnesses?
He was my family doctor. Now, my baby brother, who had one of the most serious illnesses in my family, had other than my father. He doctored my father until he died. He died of renal failure, kidney failure. And not long after my father died, my baby brother had a case of typhoid. For whatever it was in my family, Dr. Harrison took care of it if he were available. Once in a long while, somebody might get sick if he was out of town or something. There was another minority physician, Dr. Charles Bynum. Dr. Bynum maybe would see the family member in the absence of Dr. Harrison, but Dr. Harrison was our main doctor. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And what could he do to treat typhoid and renal failure? In those days.
Well, in those days, mostly, really, your treatment was supportive in terms of nutrition, and you tried to control the fever with various types of aspirin. But in those days, for typhoid, we didn't have the antibiotic that we developed later in the days of chloramycin and some of the others. And it was more or less, now I'm sure a lot of people died of the complications of typhoid, which usually the disease itself caused some kind of mini ulcers of the GI tract. Some of them were bleeding, and some of it was infected and caused a lot of pus. And the clinical characteristic of typhoid was diarrhea and inability to maintain food enough for nutrition. So the idea was to give the person kind of soft, soups, a gruel-like food to try to do the best you can to keep up the nutrition and try to control the diarrhea. Now, when it comes to renal failure, there's not much you could do with that except hope that nature would step in and kind of correct the problem. See, now in the present days with a person with renal failure, we put them on dialysis and they live on another 10 years or better. But in those days, we didn't have much to offer, really.
Did it happen quickly with your dad? Suddenly he was having troubles and then...
Dad lasted about 9 months, really. About 9 months that he lasted. When he got really sick enough for him to complain, we started having the doctor to come to see him. And he took him into the hospital's long in March when he admitted him. And of course, at that time, no minority was on staff for the hospital, Illinois Memorial Hospital. He had to refer him to another doctor, and when they ran the tests on him and found out that he really had kidney failure, we accepted it as being terminal. So that was long in March, and he lasted until June the 22nd of that year, and finally succumbed.
That was a big loss to your family.
Oh, yes. Big loss. As a child growing up, and as I mentioned before, my dad was a no-nonsense disciplinarian and whatnot. And many things as a child, I would wonder why I couldn't, like, go to the neighborhood baseball game on a Saturday afternoon or whatnot. And Dad would say, "No, I want you to go down in the field and do this or that or the other." And they always could find something that just needed to be done before Monday on Saturday afternoon. Well, and as a child, I said, "Well, I'll be glad when I get grown so I can do like I please." But suddenly when Dad left me as an 18-year-old, I found out very, very quickly that the question of do as I please was far more possible under his administration than it was for my facing the world out there. You know, the people with whom you had to do business. See, the realities of life. As an 18-year-old, I never realized the realities of life or what he had to deal with to provide for me, his child. See, I knew when it came time to eat, I always sit down, there's going to be some kind of food on the table, enough to get enough to satisfy your hunger. Now, from whence it came and how it got there, that was another problem. But I didn't know it, didn't see it then. But I had to do a whole lot of growing up in a very short time to begin to cope with the realities. And many a day, and I'm unashamed to say this, many a day when I got where it was nobody out there to face the world but me, I wished for my dad to be back in all of his restrictions and demands to be the buffer between me in a hostile world.
I'm sure you did.
Yeah, I wish for many a day, but that's a fact of life.
How was religion incorporated into your life as a child?
From an early days, I grew up in Sunday school. When it came Sunday morning, Dad did not ask, "Are you going to Sunday school?" If you were a little slow, he said, "All right, get ready, get your clothes on, so you go into Sunday school." And being brought up in that kind of a religious environment, Sunday morning always we would have the two things in the home which really underscored religion was that when it came to everybody gathered for breakfast, there would always be that family prayer around the table, a family prayer. And that's something you didn't miss no matter what you were doing. Even if you were getting a bath and had to put on your bathrobe when everybody else got ready to eat, you still showed up at the table for the family prayer. Then after that's over, you go ahead and eat or go back and finish doing what you're going to do. In that kind of an atmosphere and that kind of a setting, I placed a great value on religious beliefs and religion as a control mechanism to keep behavior within certain reasonable and human limits, where I didn't tread on your territory, and hopefully by my behavior you would not tread on my territory. And so under that kind of an atmosphere, from very early on, my religious beliefs were very strong, and I'm involved throughout my life. I was involved in the church and in church administration, and many of my contributions have come because of my beliefs in religion and the church ethic. And for that, I make no apologies. I think I mentioned in some part of the story, it was in March of 97 when we came to recognize the contributions of four minority physicians in Eastern North Carolina. When it came my weekend and my Saturday to be interviewed by Dr. Denard and have something for the program, I wanted, there's a very accomplished lady who's a soprano, and I wanted her to start it off by saying there's a deep spirit in this house, there's in this place, and I know it is the spirit of the Lord. So then I wanted closed out by a friend of mine who's a very talented baritone to do if I can help somebody. Well, the committee were wondering if this kind of a setting would have any rejections from people who were not as much a religious fanatic as I.
They were concerned about the appropriateness.
At the end. The committee members had no objection within themselves as they communicated to me, but there was some concern as to whether some of the other people who were supporting the effort, who were not as religiously inclined as I, whether there would be some rejection or whether there would be some different opinions about it. And so I listened at them for a while, maybe 4 or 5 minutes, let everybody have his say. So then my statement was, well, this is for me, And so far as my religious beliefs and the whatnot is concerned, I make no apologies. And so it will be that, so far as those two selections are concerned, they will have to be included or there won't be no program. Mm-hmm. If the program goes on, I won't be there. I said, just as simple as that, with no rancor or fear anybody, but this just, so all the committee members sat back and started shaking their head.
Can't fuss about that.
Yeah, and it went off. It went off very, very well, I thought. Not very well.
The lady who sang Sweet, Sweet Spirit, what is her name?
Name is Lucille Price. She's remarried. Her first husband died. She's a Battle now. Lucille Price Battle.
And the gentleman who sang If I Can Help Somebody, what is his name?
His name was Willard. He's a Bishop Willard's brother. Now, this Achievement Award up there with the Bishop, I can't read it by that way. Where my picture's up there. As his Bishop Leroy Willard.
That's right.
Yeah, that's his brother. And I can't think of his brother's first name, but it's
but he has a beautiful voice.
Oh, yes. He has a beautiful voice. You heard the voice on the tape?
I did.
Okay.
Both of those songs are beautifully presented there. Mm-hmm. And they're very meaningful.
Yeah, very meaningful. Very meaningful to me. Because it, to me, the people who had gathered there for this more or less testimonial, I was insistent on Ms. Price doing that number two to kind of set the tone. You know, that this is a meeting, if it's a testimony to me, I don't want any negatives. I don't want those people who may come just to see what somebody else is wearing or just to see what somebody else's apparent attitude is. I just want a whole atmosphere blanketed because of the sweetness and the togetherness. I don't even want, from the picture that is portrayed, I don't want any negatives. Don't want any controversy. This is not a controversial thing. That was my reason for wanting that particular selection. And then, as we come to the end, I live and perform based on my feeling that if I can help somebody as I pass along, then my living will not be in vain, you know. And if it gets to the point that I can't help somebody, then there's no need for me to exist, no need for me to be.
Well, you're still helping.
Yeah, that's so those two selections really put a capsule on Andrew Best, the beginning and the end, and so
makes a frame for
the whole presentation or the whole exercise.
Well, that's wonderful, and we have that on tape.
All right.
That's wonderful. I think got you grown up through your senior year in high school.
Mm-hmm.
You graduated from high school in Kinston.
In Kinston.
And what happened after that?
For 4 years after I graduated, I was involved in working with and for the family to try to pay up those debts that were incurred by my father's illness and death, and trying to support my mother and the other parts of the family. And I worked in a number of various jobs, like I had a job at some, in public works, some sawmills, the tobacco factories, and this sort of of public works to, in order to try to get some money. I had an idea to try to save some money, but when my baby brother came down with typhoid, what little money that I was saved up, had saved up, went for doctor bills. And see, he couldn't work, and he had to have those soft foods and all the things that he could tolerate nutritionally. And so whatever little we had, you know, my family had the whole attitude that as long as I have, you have. And when it gets to the point that I don't have and you don't have, you know, we just don't have. But as long as one have, we can say that we have. All right. So after 4 years, I was beginning to get a little bit anxious about getting back in school. So now time is passing on, and it seemed that every time something, I would think I had a little bit saved up to get back in school, something would come along that would demand it. So I told my mother, I said, well, I am gonna go. I'm gonna see if I can get in college. My mother said, well, I said, now you know what we have, and I would love to see you go, but I don't have anything I can help you to. I said, well, I don't know how long I'm gonna stay, but I'm gonna see if I can go. Maybe I can work my way through. And she said, well, that's up to you. So I got whatever little few pennies I could get together to get a few clothing and whatnot. And going for me was the fact that I had been involved in the 4-H clubs, and I had been going to Greensboro every year to the 4-H club short course, which was a minority thing, as then the agricultural, the extension services were totally segregated, where there was a black extension service and then the white extension service. And I, as a 4-H club boy, I had met and was acquainted with Dr. Bluford, who was the president of A&T. And one of my history professors in my high school, Mr. Elijah Baker, was a very close friend of President Bluford. So I talked with him and a couple of other my teachers and told them what I want to do. They said, well, said you deserve to go and try. They encouraged me and inspired me, motivated me, whatnot. So from there, Mr. Baker wrote me a letter, a very strong letter, to President Bluford. And I went on up to A&T, walked in Dr. Bluford's office, and he walked in. He had these glasses that are square across here, and he could wear them down on the end of his nose. So he looked up over those glasses, said, young man, said, how are you doing? So I said, I'm here, passing the letter from Mr. Baker, he read. He said, oh, said, Claire, said, so we closed registration 2 days ago. And he read the letter again. He said, well, Mr. Baker thinks a whole lot of you and of your ability. I said, well, I'm glad about that. He said, well, tell Dean Gibbs, he gave me the letter back, so tell Dean Gibbs to go ahead and see if he can find you some classes to get in. And he said, no, on second thought, I'll go myself, because now I know. I'm reflecting now because President Bluford realized that what they'd already done administratively will close the registration, not accepting anybody else. For him to reverse it, he thought he'd better go talk to Dean Gibbs himself. So he and I walked side by side from one end of the hall all the way down to the other end of the hall. And Dean Gibbs said, well, okay, Mr. President, said, if you say so, said, we'll see what we can do to find him some classes. So he signed me up. And he sent me to an English class that Dr. Arnett was the teacher. Dr. Arnett had just come back, had just gotten his PhD in English from one of the universities on the Eastern Shore. I don't know whether it's University of Penn or somewhere up there, but anyway, when I knocked on the door and went in and showed him the letter. He said, no. So you wouldn't do nothing. Just handed it right on back to him. He kept on lecturing. And with my I had a fallen crest. My feelings were really hurt. But I went back up to Dean Gibbs and I said, well, Mr. Arnett said his class is full and I wouldn't do anything. He said, well, let me see what I can do. And there's a lady, Miss Carrie Hill, and teaching English professor. And Miss Hill reminded you, encouraged you, if you've ever seen pictures of Mary McLeod Bethune, she was a very stately lady and everything. So she was very kind. Well, she said, oh, yes, and I'll take you in. So we got into her class.
You got your freshman English class.
Freshman English. And I had been out of school now, totally out of the school community for four solid years. And the quarter was half gone. It was a 12-week quarter. 6 weeks were already gone. So I went and got in her class. Then when I went to chemistry class that afternoon at 2 o'clock, Professor Green, Harry Green, said, Mr. Bess, I'd like to see you when the class is over. And so when I went approached your desk, he said, look, said, I know it's kind of late and this class is kind of going on, so I'm going to teach the same course next quarter. Said, if you want to withdraw and come in next quarter, I said, no, I said, give me a chance. He said, okay. So on my own, I went back and reviewed them books of high school chemistry and memorized all Mosley and those atomic numbers and valences and all that kind of stuff. And when, about a week after I was in there, he gave a test. And I made next to the highest mark on that, I made 98.
Good for you.
And there was one young man named Joe Massey who made 99, and there was one young lady from Oriental, North Carolina, Ada Rosa, made 100. And we were the three, so Professor Green said, he shook his head and said, when he passed out the paper, he said, well, you did all right. He said, you were in for the hall. I said, okay, thank you. And that experience went on. And at the end of the quarter, when the honor roll came out alphabetically, see, there was a fella there named Alexander whose name was on the honor roll. And my name is second name on the list, Bess, but I'm on A honor roll. And so everybody's from then on started, well, who is this guy Bess? Where did he come from? What's what? But from then on until the Army interrupted my career, I had no problems insofar as
academics
were concerned. None.
How did you pay your way the first, when you came in halfway through the semester?
Well, I didn't stay on campus. There was a lady who was the wife of a former professor at A&T. She, Dr. Spaulding, was formerly at A&T, and he had taken a job out of Langston University in Langston, Oklahoma. And his wife was still living in Greensboro, and she had some room. So I got a room through some friends of the president, Mr. Hooker and that. I got a room with Mrs. Spaulding. Well, with her husband had been in the agricultural field. He was raising some animals, some hogs and farm animals and stuff. And I got a job going out to feed the hogs. And also, Mrs. Spaulding had a central heating installed in the house. And at that time, it was the furnace was fed by a coal stoker. So you had to put coal in that stoker about every day, every 2 days, or whatever time it was. But anyway, my room rent was paid for my services to her in the, as a house handyman and a hog feeder, okay? And then I took some other odd jobs out in town, like raking leaves this time of the year, mowing the lawn as the spring came on and whatnot, to survive, to make a little money to pay my bills. And that's the way I did. And of course, in the same time, I worked as in the dining room at the then King Cotton Hotel, which is the biggest hotel in Greensboro, and they had a dining room, and they made a practice of hiring some of the A&T students to wait tables and dishwash and all this kind of stuff. So wherever there was a job to be found, I found it.
You were there.
And I worked, and to pick up my little change to stay in school.
And made your honor roll as well.
And made honor roll as well, yes indeed. And it's my second year there, I got a job on the A&T farm with the poultry man and the swine raiser. So I was working in for the school, and I moved off campus and stayed in a hut on the farm. So that was what I didn't have to pay in the room rent. And I got paid so much for that. And then as I began to go along in my education in the field of dairy husbandry, I got a job doing the bacteriological studies and the fat studies for the dairy farm.
And so when you went to college, yeah. You had intentions of coming back to the farm.
Yes, I enrolled. With my major was in agriculture. See, as a 4-H club boy and whatnot, I had the agricultural background. And my thoughts were at that time that I was getting my degree in vocational agriculture and maybe work 2 or 3 years, save a little money, and get back in med school. That was my original thought, my more or less my blueprint for my advance toward medical school, because I always had in the back of my mind med school.
From what time do you think you had in the back of your mind med school?
From day one, from my observation as a child, before I left high school, and after looking at Dr. Harrison.
I see.
So that was it. But then when I got short-stopped and went away to the service, I joined Advanced ROTC with the hope, after the Army had promised, that all the Advanced ROTC will be left to graduate with their classes, and then we'll induct them into the Army, okay? But when the battle got hot over in Europe, and the Battle of the Bulge and over in Germany and France had already been overrun, and Britain was standing in shaky shoes, all of those night bombings and everything. They began to call us up, and they sent down an order that inducted us, called all advanced ROTC called them up to active duty. And I got called in that. So at the end of the second quarter of my junior year, I went away to service, got that interruption.
Well, that interrupted not only your academic progress and your schoolwork and your career, but I understand it interrupted your social life as well a bit.
That's right. That's exactly right. Because at that time, when I might have been thinking about, hopefully, maybe I might have gotten married, if my education had flowed on through, the Army hadn't intervened.
If it hadn't been for World War II.
Hadn't been for World War II, right. And of course, we fellas had always been shaking ever since I was on the campus of A&T when the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor. And from December 7th of 1941 on, we were wondering how long this thing was going to go or whatnot. And then come April of 1943, we got the long arm of the law finally reached us. And I always remember that poster where they had that bearded man, Uncle Sam, saying, "I need you." So that we went from there then into the service and officers training school and to at Camp Breckinridge, Kentucky, after we got out of the OCS down in Fort Benning, Georgia. And on November the 26th, my birthday in 1944, I landed in Italy, one among the first contingent of replacement soldiers going, a minority soldiers going over to the European theater to fight the war in Italy. And so there we sojourned until the war ended in June, I believe it was June 8 of 45, stayed over there until we came back to stateside in 46, July,